Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. On today's episode, we will be discussing the historical origins of the post-2008 economic and political world and the shocks that took place that reshaped our current understanding of the wealth of nations. Here to discuss is our very special guest, Professor Helen Thompson. Dr. Thompson has been a professor of political economy at the University of Cambridge since 1994. Her research concentrates on the political economy of energy and the long history of the democratic, economic, and geopolitical disruptions of the 21st century. She is a regular panelist on the Talking Politics podcast and a columnist for the New Statesman. Professor Thompson, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here, Edward.
So, Professor, thank you so much for taking the time out to join us on the show today. Our discussion will center around your most recent book, Disorder, Hard Times in the 21st Century, a book that is quite illuminating to what has taken place over the past few decades and how a series of shocks has shaped our current state of affairs, not only in the Western world, but globally as well. But before we dive into some of the specifics of your book, why don't we have you talk a little bit about what motivated you to write about this topic and why you felt now was the right time to put this research forward?
Yeah, well, I started thinking about writing a book like this in 2018. And what I started with was a twofold idea, I guess. First, that it was really important to understand the shocks of 2016, and I put among them not just the obvious ones like Brexit and Trump, but the failed Turkish coup. It seemed to me that the whole year was a year in which there were just geopolitical rumblings underneath the obvious big events of the year. And I wanted to, I guess, to make sense of those to myself from a long historical perspective. And I also had this more than an intuition, it's quite hard to describe what it was, because I've been thinking about it for a few years, this sense, let's just call it that, that the problem of political understanding, that there was a problem of political understanding around the shocks of 2016, because people were starting in the wrong place, and that they weren't seeing that actually there were much bigger structural forces in play than could be accounted for by the most commonly deployed narratives about what had happened in 2016. And what I then wanted to do was to write a book that tried to connect those underlying structural factors. And I began from the premise that one of them was energy. Not that energy could explain everything or even that energy could connect everything, but that energy could explain quite a lot, and it could do quite a lot of connecting work too, between, if you like, the different disruptive forces that were going on. So I took that as my starting place. And the more that I actually worked on the book, not least actually starting writing it in the summer of 2019, the more I saw that the energy transition that we're trying to go through, and partly are going through, was part of the same long history. So I kind of brought a second set, if you like, of preoccupations to the table. How to understand the energy transition in relation to these long structural forces, and how did the energy transition and those structural forces connect to the structural forces that I'd identified as being at work in 2016. And then in terms of timing, I really in a bit got caught by events, because the original plan was for the book to come out in the autumn of 2020, but while I was writing the book, the pandemic struck, and that meant that I had to do some rethinking, not of the whole thing, but I certainly had to rethink the beginning, the framing of it. I had to scrap entirely the first chapter that I'd written and start again. And the pandemic then also came to shape some of what I wrote in the conclusion. So it was a book that sort of had a starting place, something that was added into it, and then actually I kept having to grapple to deal with a world that was changing quite rapidly right. as I was actually trying to make sense of it.
Right. Well, it's shocking how prescient your book ends up being, and we'll get into that. But the book touches on three intertemporal yet endogenous histories and the shocks that birth them. Can you talk a little bit about what exactly are those histories, how they interact, and perhaps what your research offers that you feel has been ignored by other political economy scholars?
Yeah, so I divide the book into three big histories. The first is a geopolitical history. The second is a economic history. And the third is a history of Western democracies and the European Union. And they really run along different timelines. And I try to, if you like, situate the beginning of each timeline in relation to what I thought was most important in that history. So the geopolitics history begins with what I call the beginning of the age of oil. That didn't mean that oil became the most important, that was when oil became the most important energy source in terms of volume, but that when oil began to change geopolitics, and that was really the beginning of the 20th century. And in a way, I guess the big frame for that is, what did the European countries do? Most of which didn't have any oil at all at the beginning of the 20th century. The age of coal had been one that some of them in Western Europe had dominated the world. They were the most important powers in the world in the 19th century, obviously, particularly Britain. But the 20th century was going to belong to the United States and to a lesser extent Russia / the Soviet Union, oil producing countries. And then I try to explain how the European dependency on foreign energy has just generated problem after problem after problem and different kind of remedies, none of which have actually worked. And that what we see from the 1970s is the United States entering into some of those same problems. And that I think is pretty important in understanding American policy in the Middle East from the 1970s. But then in the 2010s, which is obviously the decade that everything in the book is building to, this essentially big shock happens because the United States becomes the world's largest oil and gas producer again. And I think that was quite useful for the United States in a number of ways, but it was also very geopolitically disruptive. The economic story starts in the 1970s, and that's really because I think that that's a point in which various things fall apart, notably the international monetary order that had been set up in the post-war world. It's the era when obvious energy shocks begin, the big two oil price hikes in the 1970s. It's also the decade in which China moves towards economic reform. And we have the long-term origins of the Eurozone. So the economic part tries to tell a sort of story about how the fault lines that are generated in the 1970s develop through the 80s and 90s into the 2000s for a while as a sort of interlude. But then in the years leading up to 2008, not just 2008 itself, that the economic side of things is producing crisis. And I argue in that part of the book that there's never really a proper recovery from the 2008 crisis. In the democracy part of the book, I start with the historical origins of the idea of democracy, and in particular the idea of representative democracy. And I try to suggest that actually there hasn't been historically representative democracy without an idea of nationhood, and that these two practices are very strongly related to each other. And there, in significant part, my story is that actually nationhood was always something that had the potential to destabilize democracies at the same time as it was necessary. And that what we've seen, again, particularly from the 1970s, is that the political need for nationhood as a legitimating idea for democracy hasn't gone away, but the actual practice of getting large numbers of people in a state to believe that they belong to the same nation, that they're part of a political community, that has become much, much more difficult. And in the European Union, because you've got a counter idea, the idea of being European, a contrast to national identity, these problems are really very acute. And then what I try to do in the concluding part of the book is to try to bring these histories together and try to show the ways in which the disruptive power in each of them really comes together in the 2010s and is the context in which the shocks that we experienced in the 2010s, particularly the second half of the 2010s, took place. If you say then, well, what was different about what I was doing than what other people in political economy were doing, I think that the middle part of it, the economy part of it, is actually quite similar to approaches of a number of other political economies.
Right.
I think some of my arguments are different. I put different emphases in different places, but I think you could sort of see a certain kind of space, if you like, intellectual space in which I belong in telling that middle story. I think what makes my account of the present world different is the fact that I try to integrate that political economy approach, if you like, very explicitly with geopolitics and with the particular political problems that democratic problems generate. So in that sense, it's not economically determinist. And then I try to tie the dysfunctionalities around energy on the macroeconomic side with the dysfunctionalities, and on the financial side, with the dysfunctionalities on the geopolitical side. And I think whilst it's true in maybe even just in the last 18 months or so that there's been more geopolitics in political economy, in some sense there's been no choice but to be because of
right.
the nature of the world in which we live in. I think generally political economists have gone light on geopolitics, far too light in my view. So in some sense I try to make a contribution from joining these things up.
Right. Well, you do a great job of it. You talk about how the narrative, the story that you're talking about has played out for decades. And you say in the book that the dramatic nature of political events in 2016, from the Brexit referendum to Donald Trump's election, encouraged much short-sighted political analysis. Each of these junctures mark a significant turning point without which the present geopolitical, economic, and democratic political world would be recognizably different. But they were part of stories that had been playing out over decades, and the disruptive fault lines from which they emerged were overt in their effects as early as the middle 2000s. What were some of the most notable fault lines that you discussed?
Yeah. I would say let's pick out three or four. One of them would be China's rise, or really should be described really as China's economic return, and the particular consequences that had in a number of areas, in some sense, perhaps most significantly, energy. And so what we see in the sort of middle part of the 2000s is that China's demand for oil is rising quite rapidly. And that this ends up having, in oil price terms, an inflationary effect on the world economy. Yet, because China is also still exporting a lot of cheap goods to the rest of the world during the same time, the inflationary effects of that are masked. I mean, I still think that it's pretty inflationary when you have oil prices $150 a barrel, like you did in June 2008, when you look at the kind of price that they were, sort of not much over 100
right.
at the beginning of the year. But I think the way in which the US-China trade relationship became as contested as it was from, say, I actually think from 2015 rather than from Trump's trade war, really from the point when China articulated Made in China 2025, that the origins of that lie quite a lot earlier. And in some sense, other people would agree with that, but I want to say I think you can actually see a lot of the tensions around integrating China into the world economy by the middle of the 2000s, including to some extent protectionist pressure in the US Congress over China's exchange rate. The second thing I would pick out would be Russia's return as a geopolitical power, which we could see really pretty clearly, I would argue, by 2005. We can see severe tensions between Russia and Ukraine by that point as a result of the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. We can see Putin's willingness to use the supply of gas and pipelines around gas as a geopolitical weapon. And the issue of Europe's gas dependency in particular on Russia is being bitterly contested within the European Union by that point. So when the German government agrees to build the first Nord Stream pipeline with Russia in 2005, that was Gerhard Schröder, a member of the Polish cabinet at the time said that it was the equivalent of the Nazi-Soviet pact, effectively, you know, that carved
wow.
Poland and Ukraine. So this issue of the Nord Stream pipelines being a site of geopolitical contest, it's there. It's like right from the start. It's just that some people weren't paying attention to it. A third thing I would say that where you can see the fault line pretty clearly already in 2005 was the legitimation of constitutional change in the European Union. So in 2005, the French and the Dutch electorates both voted down the EU's constitutional treaty and in referendums. And I think that there's a fairly clear line where you can tell a story from that point on about how legitimating EU treaties became very, very difficult. And that line runs all the way to Brexit. I mean, I'll get into all the complicated bits about how that happened. But this idea that actually European Union governments wanted to push for constitutionalizing issues at the EU level, for which there wasn't a broad democratic consensus in their countries, which I think is at the heart of what, you know, the centre, if you like, of Brexit, the relationship between democracy in the United Kingdom and a treaty-bound membership of the European Union. We can see that in action by the middle of the 2000s. And then if I wanted to pick one out, which I think is perhaps the most long-term significant, it would be that in 2005, conventional oil production, that is oil that isn't produced from shale or from tar sands, largely stagnated and hasn't really recovered since. It's had a little bit above the 2005 level a few years, but not decisively so. And essentially since then, the world has been doing either on very, very high prices, like went up to 2008, or on the shale oil boom. And that one of the things that's very striking about 2019, so the year before the pandemic hit, is it already the underlying oil problem that shale was necessary in order for there to be sufficient supply in the world in relation to demand was beginning to show up. So actually less oil is produced in 2019 than in 2018. And since then, the world hasn't hit the level of 2018 again. So I think that what we could see by the mid-2000s was that a certain kind of, if you like, emergency oil politics, if we could call it that, this strange phenomenon that the shale oil boom was, rapid increase in production, lots of capital directed into a sector that to begin with wasn't profitable at all, dependent upon the monetary environment, quantitative easing and zero interest rates. That has been our way, that was our way for a decade, essentially, the world's way of dealing with the oil crisis. And what we've seen since, in different ways, is in some sense the limits to that way of dealing with it. And I think that was true before the war began.
Interesting. You you also touch on the limitations that are inherent in the populist narratives that have been put forth to explain this present context. And you say in the book, much has been written and said about the disruption of the last few decades. This has often been framed around a populist nationalism, its relation to the 2007 economic crash, and the fall of a purportedly liberal international order. But at the systemic level, much remains unexplained, not least because energy has largely gone unrecognized as an important cause of the geopolitical and economic fault lines at work, casting the pre-pandemic decade as a populist revolt, facilitating a return of nationalism, has been particularly misleading. My question is, how should we view, I mean, you've talked a little bit about it, but how should we view energy's impact on recent disruption? And why do you think oil specifically has been ignored in favor of these populist narratives? Is it simply that these populist narratives are easier for scholars to articulate to broader audiences, or do you think there's something else at play?
Yeah, if we just take an example of the role that I think oil played as a causal factor in the shocks, take one that looks on the surface like it would have nothing to do with it, oil, which is Brexit. So what I argue here is that there's a set of long-term forces at work that are making, going back, I'd say, to the origins of Britain's membership of the then European community, that are making Britain's membership of the European Union less secure. Not necessarily they're going to bring it to an end, but they're creating constant problems for governments in London. And one of them was the relationship between Britain being, or the United Kingdom, I should say, being inside the single market and being outside the Eurozone, whilst having in London the offshore financial centre of the Eurozone. That's kind of like manageable prior to the Euro crisis, the Eurozone crisis. Becomes rather more difficult during that. Now, why is that the case? There's various reasons, but one of them is that from 2011, the European Central Bank decides to raise interest rates in response to very high oil prices that have gone back over $100 a barrel. Again, it does that twice during the course of 2011, pushes the Eurozone economy overall into recession. The Bank of England, despite having higher inflation, facing higher inflation at the time, writes off that inflation. And what you see from late 2011-ish, early 2012, is a macroeconomic divergence between the United Kingdom and the Eurozone, where you get growth in the United Kingdom whilst the Eurozone's in recession. And as that happens, you start to see an increase of migration, particularly from the southern European countries, into the United Kingdom. And by the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, certainly by the end of 2013, you've got a Conservative government that's worrying about the United Kingdom Independence Party, the pro-Brexit party led by Nigel Farage. And although David Cameron doesn't make his first commitment to hold a referendum if the Conservatives win a majority, when he's particularly worried about the migration issue, by the end of that year, he very much is worried about the migration issue. So I think that once you kind of like say, okay, there are these disruptive forces and they're playing out in the connections between the different spheres, if you like, between the macroeconomic sphere, the geopolitical sphere, the way energy runs across them, and then its relationship to democratic politics, you can kind of see, you can get the underlying forces a little bit more clearly into focus. I think the reason why energy wasn't taken seriously as an account of, or sorry, as part of the story of 2016, was because generally energy isn't taken seriously unless there's an energy emergency in big oil consuming countries.
Right.
I mean, I would say that there's an oil crisis quite a lot of the time. I'd say that there was an oil crisis in 2015-16. It's just that the oil crisis was producers struggling hugely with collapsing prices. I mean, think of what happened in Venezuela from that time, where effectively the oil price crash of late 2014 pushes Venezuela into a humanitarian crisis. In Western countries, particularly in Europe, where, you know, where there's not many oil producers left, we just say, okay, that's nice, we've got very low oil prices. Don't think of it as an oil crisis. We think of it as an oil crisis when prices are $150 a barrel or whatever it was earlier this year when they were $120. But what I'm saying is under the oil situation that we're in the world, there's always an oil crisis going on somewhere.
Right.
It's just a question of who's being afflicted.
Sure.
By it.
Yeah. on the subject of the power of oil, you note in the book that in April 2016, the Saudi government threatened to sell its portfolio of treasury assets if Congress passed a bill allowing U.S. citizens to sue the Saudi government for 9/11. And you say when Congress passed the bill, President Obama vetoed it, only for Congress to override his veto. You also say that the world has in part become more unstable over the past decade because as the United States has acquired more energy power. Why do you think the U.S. has made the world more unstable? And in the years to come, do you see oil and those nations that earn significant revenues through oil exports having increased political power? Or do you think that the emergence of renewables will decrease their influence?
Yeah, in terms of like the US's position, I think we have to separate this out into two parts of the world where I think the disruptive effect of the shale boom has been rather different. I think where oil is concerned, its primary disruptive effect was in the Middle East, and particularly to the US-Saudi relationship. So that moment that you're describing is part of a low point in the US Saudi relationship. So the US moves from being rather dependent upon Saudi Arabia from the 1970s to becoming much less dependent upon Saudi Arabia once the shale boom's taken off. And at the same time, that allows the Obama administration a certain kind of freedom in its mind about Middle Eastern policy. That his immediate predecessors, perhaps you could say, going all the way back to Carter, Nixon didn't have. And one of those freedoms was the freedom to sanction Iran in the hope of getting a nuclear deal, in the belief that the sanctions against Iran would not take oil to too high a price, that the Europeans could tolerate Iran not exporting much oil into world markets. And as we know, that's what happened. An agreement was struck in 2015. That was not at all something the Saudis were happy about. And that was going on at the same time as Saudi Oil Company was having to compete with American shale companies for market share. And the way in which the Saudis initially responded to that was, okay, we'll just try and bankrupt the shale sector. They won't be able to tolerate it at the low prices. And that was going on during the course of 2015, very much so, and into 2016. And they found that they could damage the shale sector like that. There were bankruptcies, but nothing like enough in order to do serious damage to the US as an oil producer. And it was out of that weakness that Saudi Arabia then had to turn to Russia to put together the new oil cartel, OPEC Plus. But what we came out of that was both a lot of turbulence in Saudi Arabia. Remember the point in which it looked like members of the royal family were basically being imprisoned in a hotel in Riyadh. Turbulence that sort of slipped over into the relations with Lebanon, disputes between the Americans and the Saudis about what was going on in Syria, particularly after Putin had Russian military intervene in Syria. So you had a great deal of turbulence going on in the Middle East, which was essentially a more competitive relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, which had been a relationship of mutual dependency. If you turn to Europe, what's really going on here comes from the gas front. And that was because Russia was used to basically having a stronghold on the European market. It had acted quite effectively to contain the amount of competition coming from Azerbaijan or from Iran. And then with the shale gas boom and the prospect that the United States was going to become an gas exporter, which it did from around the middle of the decade, Russia had got a competitor. You're basically having American firms competing with Gazprom about the European market. That was a great threat from Putin's point of view. And you had divisions between the European countries, between European Union members, NATO members coming to the fore. So you had those like Poland, Baltics, that very much wanted to buy shale gas from the US. And then you had a country like Germany that wanted very much to stick with its pipelines contracted. The contracted gas it was receiving through pipelines from Russia and didn't build any liquid natural gas ports. So I don't think it's possible to understand how energy divided the European countries from each other and ultimately from the United States without understanding the power of shale gas to rewrite the geopolitics of gas in Europe.
So let's talk a little bit further about the transition to renewables. You mentioned in the book that geopolitically, an energy change will necessarily result in upheaval. If Britain were the power that climbed to dominance during the age of coal, and the U.S. the power that ascended during the age of oil and coal, the specter haunting Washington is that without a decisive American strategic return to renewables and electrification, the new energy age that depends on metals and minerals will belong to China. Why do you think this is the case, and do you see China in any way causing disruptions to the future of the U.S.-China trade relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's reasonably well understood now that solar and wind turbine manufacturing, electric vehicles, batteries, all, if you like, the infrastructure of the energy transition, of powering the world economy in different way in energy terms. All this requires vast amounts of metals and minerals. And right now, China dominates the supply chains around metals, to a quite staggering extent. In a number of areas particular. China also has probably dominates, say, in the electric vehicle sector at the moment. Now, I don't think you can just sort of read from that a view that, the low carbon energy age will belong to China. I mean, that also like begs questions about where power might lie geopolitically in relation to nuclear power. Nonetheless, it does matter. And you can see that it matters because people in Washington are being very worried about it, want the United States to have a mineral strategy, a metal and mineral strategy. You can see that people in European capitals are worried about it. The Europeans have raw materials alliance, which, has one of its fundamental aims is to try to improve Europe's position in relation to these supply chains. Now, I think in principle, you can say that the supply of metals and minerals can be used as a geopolitical weapon. I mean, China actually imposed a ban on rare earths on Japan. I think it was back in like 2010 after one of their maritime disputes. So if we say, is there the equivalent of the oil weapon or the gas weapon where metals are concerned? If one country completely dominates or largely dominates the production and supply chains, yes, that's the case. Is it quite the same as when a country has a very large supply of oil and gas or oil or gas. I'm not quite so sure. In part, I think China's advantages have come because China has been committed strategically to metal extraction and metal production for as long as China has. I mean, China's had a rare earth strategy, rare earth strategy going back to the 1950s to the early Mao era. And clearly, I think the position in Washington in particular is that the United States can catch up, that this isn't just a given in the way in which really where the oil in the world is more of a given. I mean, I know some of it was late in being discovered, but I think it's at least possible from what I understand that metals are not quite as arbitrarily distributed under the Earth's surface as oil and gas are. But I think it already geopolitically matters because we can see that Western countries do not want to be dependent upon China. Indeed, particularly from Europe's point of view in many ways, or European countries' point of view, one of the points of the energy transition is supposed to get away from the problem of energy dependence, from resource dependence, and try and create conditions of energy and resource independence. And that's going to be a forlorn hope if you just switch dependency upon Russian gas to dependency upon Chinese controlled lithium mining, for instance.
You talk about the prices for consumers. You know that whatever the low unit cost of producing solar or wind powered electricity at the system level, especially in those places like Germany where renewables are a significant portion of the sector, the inefficiencies of intermittent renewable capacity has thus far often yielded higher electricity prices for consumers. Why do you think this has been the case? And is there any truth in the notion that renewable energy has, in fact, increased fossil fuel consumption?
Well, I think there's two different things here. I mean, the one thing that's true in the most basic sense is that you can't produce, you can't manufacture any solar panel or any wind turbine without using fossil fuel energy to do so. So the very nature of increasing solar and wind production requires as inputs fossil fuel energy. Maybe that will change at some point in the future, but that is where we are now. So actually, you know, present fossil fuel energy inflation also causes inflation in renewable manufacturing. I think that Germany, but not only Germany, of the European countries, shows the difficulties that we're in where moving to a decarbonized electricity sector is concerned. Because as we know, Germany is the country that has probably been taking the energy transition more seriously for longer than any country in the world. Certainly, I would say where its electricity sector is concerned. And the optimistic take about decarbonizing the electricity sector is look how quickly unit costs for producing solar electricity and wind electricity have fallen over the last decade or so in particular. But if you can't make either solar or wind the basis of your grid system, if you've always got to have at least one other energy source, usually more than that, that are going to do the work when solar and wind can't do the work, then the overall cost of the system depends actually on the costs of the other energy sources. And it may well actually depend upon how difficult it is to use, like say in the British case, a very small amount of coal for only some of the time in an emergency. So you're constantly upping them, you know, you're basically having to like scale up coal production only in some sense, not quite in a margin call in the financial sense, but as I say, a near emergency moment. So it seems to me that right now we have to think about the systemic costs of the energy mix in generating electricity. Are wind and solar helping that? In some sense, they are, because they make the unit cost, particularly like solar, low. But in periods in which actually what happens is that they're running, that solar and wind are running nowhere near capacity, and these other energy sources are having to do the work, then actually they're not a remedy for the problem. And I say, I'm not saying that, I don't say that because I'm trying to be anti-solar and wind, quite the contrary. I'm just saying is that you can't separate out how that they work and the costs of how they work from the interaction that there has to be with other parts of the energy mix. Because if you're a North European country in particular, you cannot run your electricity system off only wind and sun. I mean, Merkel said herself in a speech in early 2020, there are parts of the world where this works a lot better than Germany.
Right.
And that, I think, is a, it is a constraint for the Northern European countries in particular. Obviously, the Southern European ones can do quite a lot better with solar than the Northern European one can, certainly like Britain or Germany. But even Britain, which is very, it's not propitious, as we know, where solar is concerned at all, but it's pretty propitious where wind is concerned. I live on a narrow, damp, windy island. But actually, UK wind production hasn't been doing that well for the last 18 months or so. Wind levels have been low, and that's been one of the problems during the course of this year. And it's why gas consumption in the electricity sector has been as high as it has in Northern Europe, because the wind levels for what could normally be expected at particular times of year have been below average.
Yeah. One thing that, shifting a bit to inflation, because it's been such a hot topic, it was interesting to me how accurately you predicted our current bout of inflation. In particular, that price increases would be predominantly the result of rising energy prices. Do you see the price of energy and its impact on inflation persisting into the medium term? And what do you think are going to be some of the, I guess, long term public finance implications of these high energy costs?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty difficult now to imagine circumstances or to see circumstances in which energy prices fall without there being a recession, if not recession, very, very sluggish growth. And that is because there are clear now supply constraints around both oil and gas in relation to demand in the world. So if things are okay on the demand side, because growth's doing okay, then there's going to be pressure on the supply side, and that means that prices are going to be going up. I think this is part of the predicament that we've been in, as I suggested earlier, I would say since the middle of the 2000s, which is that generally oil prices are either going to be too high for the net importing countries and their consumers, or they're going to be too low for the net exporting countries and their state revenues, in the case of those who've got state-owned oil firms. And actually, any kind of equilibrium is pretty difficult to see. So in that sense, we can trade one set of economic problems for another set of economic problems. I mean, I finished writing the book before it became, which was, I finished writing it or doing the last edits to it in the summer of 2021, before it had become quite clear how much Chinese gas demand had accelerated during the course of 2021. So before the big spike in gas prices in Europe and in Asia in the latter part of 2021, before Omicron hit. But I think we are now pretty much the same position as a result with gas that we've been at with oil since, I would say, the middle of the 2005. So there's probably a bit more there are more possibilities, I think, for increasing gas production over the medium term than there are of increasing oil production at affordable prices anyway, over the medium term. So whilst I don't think we're going to be always living with energy inflation, and at a certain point when prices plateau, it stops being inflationary, I think we're going to be always living with one set of economic problems that energy generates.
Right.
And that might be on the recessionary side rather than on the inflationary side. But I think that what will happen is the recession will mean that the prices will come down. As soon as we start to get some recovery from that recession, we'll run back into supply constraints and the prices will be back on the way up again.
Yeah. So to sort of wrap up, I have a couple more questions. What, if any, have been some of the early criticisms of your book, and how would you respond to those critiques?
I think there's been a set of criticisms that I was too critical, been too critical about the European Central Bank, and you know, somewhat disputing my account of the relationship between the Eurozone crisis and Brexit. I mean, you know, I stand by what I said about the European Central Bank. I mean, one thing I would say here that in a way is a function of the way I decided to organise the book, which I think, you know, has, shall we say, there was a case for it, which was to divide the history up into these three histories and then try to put them back together again, is that it means that all the bits of the argument I make about certain things like Brexit, for instance, appear in like three different places and they come back together again in the conclusion. So I think that I might be read as suggesting a more determinist account of Brexit from the Eurozone crisis than I'm actually making, because my argument is really that there's a set of issues that are going on around that disjuncture between Britain being inside the single market, outside the Eurozone and having the offshore financial centre of the Eurozone, and this set of issues about the democratic legitimation, constitutional change in the European Union and how that intersected with democratic elections in the United Kingdom. So I can see whereby someone might say you don't quite pull all that together, in the sense of like how any particular episode that's being impacted by all the different structural forces. I haven't then got more chapters that say, okay, this is all the bits together that explain Brexit, if you see what I mean. All these are all the bits together that explain Trump. And I can see that there is a kind of downside to that. I think the other issue, and this is just an issue that I like wrestled with myself in terms of how to do the book, is what is the relationship between the structural forces and anybody's individual political judgment in this? And in a way, the fact that I published the book in the UK anyway, on the day that Putin invaded Ukraine, really brought that issue to the fore, because on the one hand, I did have a count, I think, as to why Ukraine was such a fault line. In fact, mm-hmm. I kind of made it the principal fault line of post-Cold War Europe and said it existed like right from the beginning, and it was very much tied up with these energy questions. But have I got an account in the book of why Putin would have reached the decision that he did, not just to attempt to conquer parts of Ukraine, which I think I could account for quite easily in what I said, but actually to engage in regime change, you know, his initial aim. I'm not sure that I do have an explanation of that. I think you might actually at this point say, okay, structural forces, they're important, they explain quite a lot, but could we really capture that this moment of hugely consequential decision-making? It's not like it doesn't matter in terms of my long-term structural history. It very much matters. It's very much in terms of it in some sense, but have I really got an account of it in there? I don't think so.
Yeah.
So I think that tension, you know, it is there in my account of what's going on. Now, I'm not going to repudiate what I've written. I still think there's a lot that can be captured by trying to analyze the long-term structural forces in the way in which that I do, but I don't think it's like a comprehensive, exhaustive, at least, not exhaustive is a better word. I don't think it's an exhaustive explanation. I still think in an ideal way, if you could try and grapple with everything at the same time, there would be a bit more space for, okay, what were all the contingent factors as well as the structural factors, including those contingent to Putin himself, that can explain why this man took that decision and changed the world in which way he did on.
That would be impossible to model. That would be so difficult. Yeah. So to wrap up, I guess, what are some of the key points from your book that you hope policymakers will take home, and what do you hope, I guess, you know, some of your readers will take away from this extensive research, if there's one thing that's, I guess, most important?
I think in the policy front, it would be the way things are joined up, particularly perhaps the energy, monetary, finance dynamics. Because I think, and I get this when I talk to people in the policy world, the sense that too much policy making is in silos, and there's not a great deal of systemic analysis and how the consequences flow from like one area to next. I mean, if you just wanted an example from recent days, I think it's pretty clear that the British government in making the mini budget that it did not seem to understand the role of, you know, UK government bonds and the way in which the financial system around pension funds works, the fact that they effectively work as collateral in the financial system. So the fact that you have to understand so many different factors to grapple with the complexity of the modern economic and political world, that is what I think want policymakers to get out of it. And then I think more general readers would be just to see how important energy is, and just to understand that in some sense, in an energy crisis like the world is in now, we all have, in some sense, I think, a responsibility to ourselves and to each other to understand the place of energy. That it's not something we can just sort of take for granted, be complacent about, switch off.
Right.
That we need to understand it as something that can, in some sense, disappear in the emergency or become incredibly difficult. And I don't think that we're going to navigate our way as individuals through this world in the next, you know, however long this crisis is going to last, unless we can try to understand energy in fundamental importance to the way in which we all live our lives, and to try to understand what the consequences of where we've got to in energy terms are.
Well, that's it for us here at The Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's episode with Professor Helen Thompson. Make sure to check out all the episodes of The Demand Side on The Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit thedemandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose the demand side. Until next time.